Thanks for listening to Chicago's Morning Answer podcast, sponsored by Signature Bank. Signature Bank takes pride in helping customers grow their business and provide unmatched banking expertise, custom financial solutions, and the industry's best technology. So whether you're a business looking for a deposit relationship or needs a ready source of financing, Signature Bank is the right bank for you. Call today at 773-467-5600 to hear how Signature Bank can help your business grow and thrive. Member FDIC, Equal Housing Lender.
This is Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan Proft and Amy Jacobson on AM 560, The Answer.
Sports and politics and sports and politics and sports and politics and intersection. Arrogance and ignorance, arrogance, ignorance, and arrogance and ignorance. Intersection.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy. So, we kick off with sports and politics because you had the big basketball game yesterday that everybody cares about. Nobody cares about Purdue and UConn. Men's basketball is not interesting. It's all women's basketball all the time now because that's the such a fundamentally sound version of basketball. It's really the premier athletic event of the year, the NCAA Women's Basketball Championship, or at least it is now and for the time being, as long as Caitlin Clark is around.
Right. UConn-Iowa game, 14 million people watched that game. And it was an exciting game. I'm sorry, the Purdue game, the UConn boys' Final Four over the weekend or on Saturday night. Those games were boring. They weren't even close. This was exciting. And last night's game, I know, even though the Hawkeyes lost, it was an exciting game. Did you watch it at all? I mean, the first quarter was awesome. Caitlin Clark scored 18 points. I can tell you you didn't watch it. Did you even try it out? Because John Anthony, who filled in for you, say, I don't watch women's basketball. Well, then how do you know what you're missing?
Yeah, I've seen it before. I'm familiar with the concept, so it's not that complicated. Yeah, I watched a little bit of it.
Nothing.
I'm of course it dwarfs the UConn Purdue game tonight. I understand.
Well, we'll see how many people watch the UConn Purdue game. I'm going to watch both because I like basketball.
Yeah, we'll see.
I'm sure.
It's a mystery. I mean, no one knows which is the more popular sport. Men's basketball or women's basketball at the collegiate level. It's an imponderable. No one knows this. We have no data on this. So we'll just have to see how it turns out. I mean, it's a complete blank slate. This is uncharted territory.
Yeah. 312-642-5600, turnkey.pro answer line. You could also text us at 64636. Type in DA, then a quick comment.
You know, it's just amazing to me to watch people celebrate being patronized.
Really?
Well, that's what it is. Now, all hands are on deck for women's basketball. Everything about the game is glorious. I'm a huge women's basketball fan. I like men's basketball. Uh-huh. But now, really, I've turned my attention completely to women's basketball for 5 minutes while everybody is talking about Caitlin Clark. But it's just such a gorgeous game. I've fallen in love with it. All I want to do now is play women's basketball. And I want to pander and patronize women about the game. And, I watched it and how many people watched it this one time. And how much money Caitlin Clark is going to make. And how much did she make in NL. Everything's so fascinating about the sport. I had no idea these features of the sport existed until Caitlin Clark came along 2 weeks ago in this tournament, as far as most people know, and just set the world ablaze, even though she lost she and Iowa lost a championship game. She wasn't even the high scorer in the semifinal game. It's not to say that she's not the best player in women's basketball. She is, but I mean, it's so patronizing, and people just love to be patronized. I don't. I guess that's where I'm different, and I don't patronize people. I can't go along with this zeitgeist of pretending that there is a new day in women's basketball. And hey, fellas, you better look out because the nation is turning its attention. Okay. So anyway, the thing that was more interesting about the game was the pregame and the pregame press conference, because the coach of the South Carolina women's team,
Dawn Staley,
the Lady Cox.
Yeah, right. Lady.
Dawn Staley is her name. She was asked the question of the hour. By the way, this is great. I'm so glad that one of these aspiring members of the political press corps that toil in the sports press corps and have to cover women's basketball asked this question to try to gain some relevance, because it's just a reminder. Everybody's going to get asked this question.
Mm-hmm. So you better be prepared, because she was not prepared for the question.
You better be prepared with the right answer. Because, of course, there's only one right answer. Dawn Staley in the pregame presser.
One of the major issues facing women's sports right now is the debate, discussion topic about the inclusion of transgender athletes, biological males, in women's sports. I was wondering if you would tell me your position on that issue.
Damn, you got deep on me, didn't
you? Not really.
No.
I'm under the opinion of if you're a woman, you should play. If you consider yourself a woman and you want to play sports, or vice versa, you should be able to play. That's my opinion. You want me to go deeper?
Do you think transgender women should be able to participate?
That's your question. You want me to ask? I mean, you want to ask, so I'll give you that. Yes, yes. So now, the barnstorm of people are going to flood my timeline and be a distraction to me on one of the biggest days of our game, and I'm okay with that. I really am.
That's why you brought it up, because you're okay with it. 312-642-5600, turnkey.pro answer line, 64636-DA, turnkey.pro text line.
No, the follow-up question would be, okay, so you love your players so much, because she kept talking about how she's not only close to the players, Dan, she's close to the people that the players love. So which one of your players that you love, like a family member, are you going to cut for a trans man to join your team? What are you willing to sacrifice? You can say that all day, but when it comes to it, where are you going to cut? Because that's coming next. You don't think the transgender community is eyeing? They're already trying to take over volleyball. They're going to be taking over women's basketball. And that will be the death of women's basketball. So all this fanfare and fans that they got this year because Iowa was like America's team. You know, clean-cut girls. They didn't have tattoos on them. No fake eyelashes. All that garb. They're like a real basketball team. That's all going to go away when they start letting transgender males into women's basketball.
South Carolina or... these other, they're real basketball teams too.
Okay.
I mean, what does fake eyelashes and tattoos have to do with whether or not you can play basketball?
I just had to vent. I didn't like the
look. I don't like
the
it either.
Cut of their jib, as
but
you
that
might
has nothing
say.
To do
yes.
With whether or not you're a basketball team or you can play basketball. I don't like that. The tat culture generally. Of course, women aren't going to be immune to it. It's all over. I mean, that's the culture. I can't defile myself fast enough. That's everywhere. And it's not just basketball, obviously. So why would they be excluded? What you celebrate, you beget. How many examples do you need? What you celebrate, you beget. What you extol, you get more of. Is this complicated? I am going to recognize you, single you out, if you do these things. Okay, I'm going to do these things, especially young people. And then they're so unique and they're so special that they all do the same thing. Okay, so there's where Dawn Staley stands. You know, so next year, if I'm if I was a college women's basketball coach,
okay,
which, and this would, if I did this, or if somebody did this, you know, their coaching career would be over. But you know what? Some things are more important. When South Carolina came up on the schedule, I field the state championship high school boys team from my state. I just say, or you know, how many ever I could get to identify as girls, or some pickup team, you know, just some intramural team of college male juniors, sophomores, freshmen, whatever. And I put that on. That's my team's on the. I pull the Normandale. My team's on the court. It's right there. They're all girls. And watch my boys that of high school age take apart the undefeated national champion.
They practice against boys, though. They have men try, because Russell, my youngest, Eli, looked into doing this to trying out for that team. They play against men every day. They have a men's squad that the Iowa women's team scrimmages on a daily basis at every practice.
What's your point?
They hang with them.
Yeah.
And they've made them better.
Yeah. So anyway, like, pick a state champion. Pick a high school, even if they don't play college. Pick one of the teams. Who won the IHSA boys basketball?
Was it Loyola? No, that was girls. Loyola girls won.
So pick Flossmoore teams from a bygone era. How about that Glenbard West team from a couple years ago?
Right. That's a good team.
And I'll just put them out. And when it comes time to play South Carolina, put them out and watch them dismantle the undefeated state champion from a year prior. Or whoever the best, whoever wants to ascribe to the view that Dawn Staley has, and see if that changes her mind. Only consequences will get people off the sentimental barbers. And it was interesting too, because Sage Steele reacted to Dawn Staley. Love and respect Dawn Staley. Hate she didn't have the courage to speak the truth, especially because I don't think there's any way she actually believes what she said. Her hesitation spoke volumes. Dawn knows damn well that she'd never be a Hall of Famer if she played against men, period. So it's irresponsible and unfair for her and other retired female players in all sports to conveniently say that they're now okay with this. It's irresponsible and unfair to the girls and women who look up to them, and they know it. Isn't it crazy that we never see women trying to go play in the NBA or with the U.S. men's team? Yeah, right. Really, it's real crazy. Or on the PGA Tour? Right, yeah. It's who can figure this out? It's just, it's unknowable. Here's something else, too. Who knows what these things are? Women, what would happen if a woman wanted to play in the NBA, if that 6'7 chick from South Carolina wanted to play in the NBA? Who knows what would happen? Yeah, right. It's
destroyed.
A mystery. So this is the point. They know it's true, and that's exactly the right word Sage Steele uses. Don't have the courage to speak the truth. Well, we're going to help people find their courage, it seems. Riley Gaines is doing that. Here's what Riley Gaines had to say on a stop of her tour of the United States, standing up for women in women's sports, to the Utah governor.
Oh, boy.
This guy, Spencer Cox, who's on the down low, I think. I don't know for sure. But
does his wife know?
Spencer Cox vetoed legislation that would prohibit men from playing girls' sports.
Now, 24 states have enacted some sort of fairness in women's sports bill that ultimately protects sports on the basis of sex. Your wonderful governor here in this state vetoed this legislation. And you want to know what his excuse was? I'm watching the press conference. He said he wanted to err on the side of compassion. I've got a question for you, Governor Cox. Who are you being compassionate towards? Because it's not women. It's not your daughters. He doesn't care about them. Is it compassionate to ask a young girl to undress in front of a man? Is that what compassion is? We must have two totally different definitions of compassion and inclusion. Oh, is it inclusion to ask us to smile and step aside and allow these men onto our podiums? No, I think we previously called that exclusion. And it's exclusive to the very females, the very women who Title IX in the women's sporting category was passed and created, implemented to protect. Call out your leaders here in this.
Yeah, and your coaches too. Your coaches who support sanctioned cheating. There's the follow-up question. I see. So you support sanctioned cheating in women's basketball, Coach Daly, right? That's what it is. Bill and Glen Ellen.
Yeah, you kind of stole my thunder, Dan, because I was going to say, the best game of the season would be Caitlin Clark's team versus any random high school boys team. You know, that would be an interesting game to watch.
Oh, I'd love to see it.
I think it would reveal a lot.
Thanks for the call, Bill. Sure, they should.
No, I would love to say, if I was a billionaire and won the Powerball, I would have.
They should go. Why? They have the money to do it. These programs do. Look at, so, So do a tour. Do a women's basketball tour. Put together a women's all-star team and let's play some boys' teams.
Problem is the size of the ball is different now. So would we play with the women's size ball or the men's size ball? It's a big difference.
Think about that for a second as you process this argument that women can compete with men.
Well, it wasn't our choice. I mean, I was a junior in high school. They changed the ball size. Like, well, okay, now we've changed. Now we're changing the rules again. Why are you changing the rules?
Good, then you'll play with the men's ball.
You got to practice. It
doesn't matter to you, so we'll play with the men's ball then. Because it doesn't matter.
Well, Caitlin Clark better get to it. She every day before she leaves practice, she makes 100 free throws, 100 3-pointers.
Jim and Crown Point.
100 layups.
A younger name is Lady Gamecocks.
Well, it's...
Yeah, go ahead, Jim.
The name Lady Gamecocks is very misogynist. They should be the transgenders. When I watch women's sport, well, let me say I have 7 sisters, 3 daughters, and 40 nieces. So... I'm inundated with women, and I love women, but when I watch a woman's sport, it's like I'm watching curling. The speed is so much different. It's, you know.
Of course it is. Thanks for the call, Jim. That's the first thing you notice. Of course it is.
The stories you need to know to start your day. This is Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560. The Answer.
Business owners, now's the time for your business to make the move to a locally owned business bank. Hi, Mike Gallagher here to let you know that you don't have to look far. Signature Bank was founded in Chicago with a simple mission to help companies like yours grow, succeed, and thrive. Their decisions are made locally by a terrific team that knows your name, cares about your business, and invests in your success. That's why Signature Bank is my bank. I'm a customer. As business owners, they knew that local family-owned businesses were not getting the help they needed or deserved. So, I invite you to reach out to my friends at Signature Bank today. Write the number down. Remember this phone number, Signature Bank, 773-467-5630. And learn all about this great bank, 773-467-5630. Or visit them online at signaturebank.bank. That's signaturebank.bank. Signature Bank makes commercial banking personal. Member FDIC, Equal Housing Lender.
Looking for the latest news, insight into what it means, and the sharpest opinion. There's only one station in Chicago where you can turn, and it's this one. We're AM 560, The Answer.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy. We're talking a little bit about last night's South Carolina-Iowa women's basketball championship game, which, of course, South Carolina won, but not so much about the game or women's basketball, but the coach of South Carolina, Dawn Staley, who was asked pregame what she thinks about men playing women's basketball, and she basically punted the issue. Well, she didn't punt the issue. No, she sort of fell in line that, you know, if you identify as a woman, you can play women's basketball because that's what I'm supposed to say.
Yeah, Stage Seal said her pause spoke volumes.
Yeah, it spoke volumes. It says, I'm a coward.
Right, yep. No, she is.
And that's America's social pathology right now, the lack of courage to say what you know to be true. Paul and Carrie, you're on Chicago's Morning Answer.
Yeah, you sort of touched on this already. I'm curious if we continue to go down this rabbit hole for those trans women, when does it become irrelevant? The points, blocks, or goals? If those same trans women were to go into men's sports and it's more about feeling good, and at least we're doing, according to them, the right thing.
Thanks for the call. Well, I mean, I hope more women don't try to get into men's sports, because we've seen a few examples of that, particularly contact sports. And, for example, a woman pretending to be a man who almost got killed in the UFC octagon. I mean, it's absurd. It's absurd that Dana White sanctioned that. It's absurd that that occurred. But this is where we're at. We don't have the courage to say what we know to be true as a culture. And so, yeah, women are going to get their brains beat in if they put themselves in harm's way by participating in a men's sport, a men's contact sport, at least. But the other thing about this, too, you know, we fall into this trap. We were just talking about, you know, and I initiated it, so I guess I'm to blame. But this idea, like, you know, men versus women. Can women compete against men? And so we'll throw a high school basketball team up against Iowa or South Carolina. and watch them win the same way a group of 15-year-old boys beat the U.S. national women's soccer team at the heyday of Megan Rapinoe. But that's not the point. But what we already know this. We know what the truth is. We know that physiologically, women can't compete with men. So what are we arguing about? I know we have some of these, like, you know, goofy women's rights people who harken back to when Bobby Riggs threw that match against Billie Jean King so he could pay off a mob bookie, which is actually what happened.
That's what happened.
But, and is that, oh, you know, women are just as good. Yeah, they're just as good with the technical aspects of the game competing against other women.
It's just a different game.
So just leave it there. Why do we even, I shouldn't have gotten into it. Why do we even get into it? Enjoy women's sports and great female athletes for what they contribute within their peer group the same way you would men. Who wants to see Joel Embiid play against women, you know, at the WNBA? It would be absurd. It would be offensive. So why isn't it the other way? It's just, we know it. But, I mean, again, this interview I did with William Bach, the former head of the anti-doping agency who was on the NCAA infractions committee and just resigned, his words, resigned because the NCAA is sanctioning cheating in women's sports.
Because that's what it is. That's the bottom line.
That is what it is. And at the NCAA infractions committee level, people just like Dawn Staley, the lack of courage to say what you know to be true. Oh, Bill, I really, and this is what he said, you know, I really appreciate you taking the stand, Bill. You did the right thing. It's important what you did. Now, I'm going to try and work on reform from the inside. No, you're not. No, you're not. You're just covering your cowardice. That's what you're doing. You're not trying to work on anything. You're trying to protect your status, your relationships, the business opportunities that come from being on the NCAA infractions committee and so on and so forth. That's what this is. But it's just remarkable, as Riley Gaines says, that we have all these mediocre men in this country who would rather put their daughter in harm's way in so many instances where you have a male competing, or have their daughter's accomplishments taken away, as Riley Gaines's were, than to risk being chided by the powers that be in your community or the sporting world or the larger culture. How pathetic. So, you know, that's a call to see if men are going to be protectors or not. As we've said before, we'll see. Speaking of men being protectors, violent crime in America's big cities.
But they keep telling you it's down.
Yeah, now this is the new approach. Before we get to that, quickly, Bob in Naperville, you're on Chicago's Morning Answer.
Yeah, I just a previous caller brought up the name Gamecocks. I don't think they'll have to be changing the name from Lady Gamecocks anytime soon.
Yeah, no, exactly.
Oh, I see.
So, you know when there's a pivot in terms of messaging from the left, because you have people all over the country repeating it. And so last week, Muriel Bowser was on, she's the mayor of D.C. She was asked on with Joe Kernan on CNBC and asked about this, you know, violent crime in D.C. What are you talking about? Violent crime's down. Don't tell your daughter, because he's asking about his daughter who lives in D.C., Kernan was. Tell your daughter not to worry. We know what we're doing, working.
My daughter's there, and I'm a nervous person already. So she's in her, you know, in her 20s. I already worry. She worries. She's scared. She doesn't feel safe. She had a place broken into, and someone got shot on her block. And she wanted me to just ask you, what's the answer? Do you have a plan? Is it broken windows that you got to do more of that, or is it more funding for police? What's the plan? Should she feel safe in D.C., Mayor Bowser?
Absolutely, and this is what you should know. I just got an update from my deputy mayor, and crime is down in all categories in Washington, D.C., especially those categories that so troubled us last year with robbery and carjacking, down more than 30%. So we've done the things that we know will reset our public safety ecosystems.
Mm-hmm. She's not the only one who's noticing how safe D.C. is. A P-Butt was on with his gal pal, Jen.
Bring it. Come on, a little longer.
I don't have the breath I used to when I was a young man.
Yeah.
I don't have that.
Seek, ski.
The lungs. P-Butt.
How's P-Butt doing, our NBC intern?
D.C. is great.
But the simple facts and the simple reality are right here staring us in the face, including the fact that I can safely walk my dog to the Capitol today in a way that you couldn't do when we all got here.
Doesn't he have a security detail?
Of course he does.
And he's the one who drove up with the security detail one time, got his bike out, and then rode up to the Oval Office.
Yeah. He doesn't know what you're talking about.
He's an everyday guy.
This violent crime in D.C., he can walk his dog to the Capitol. He and Chasen swing on their swing in the backyard,
the
uninterrupted, except when Chasen's off at camp grooming young kids to join the LGBTQ boond.
Is he still chest feeding? Because he was doing that earlier.
Didn't come up. Great question, though.
Thank you.
By the way, this is from the Amazon Post, you know, that right-wing rag, Jeff Bezos' outlet. 2023 was the district's deadliest year in more than two decades. But in the first quarter of this year,
it was going great.
I mean,
like the Iowa game, the first quarter was going great. And
it's finally kicking in. All of the groundwork we've laid is finally bearing fruit. Eric Adams, so there's Bowser and P-Butt. On D.C.
He's not in this, too, is he?
Eric Adams. What is all this subway crime people are talking about? He goes down there. He talks to folk. No idea what all this reporting on alleged subway crime in New York City is about.
Can we please stop saying we're up in crime in our subway system? We are not.
What?
We're down in crime in the subway system. Bringing transit crime down overall for the year 2024, that's what we've done this quarter. And let me repeat this again. Transit crime is down. Our public transit system, especially our subway system, is the lifeblood of our city. I said it over and over again. And New Yorkers are safe on our subway system. I'm down there talking to the passengers, communicating with them. And many of them keep saying over and over again as we move through the subway system, they say to me, Eric, can people stop saying we're unsafe down here? It's the best subway system on the globe, and we're the safest on the globe.
Safest on the globe.
In the world. Congratulations. Wasn't the governor called the National Guard out to the subway system because it was so violent?
That was into this year. And by the way, this from the end of last month, well, the end of February. Subway crime rocketed in the first 2 months of 2024, rising nearly 20% compared to the same time last year, driven by big increases in grand larcenies, felony assaults, and robberies, according to newly released NYPD statistics. But so that was through February. But the last 30 days... We've become the safest subway system on the globe.
In the world. Yes, congratulations.
It's not happening. And you get the same rap from BLM Brandon.
Oh, yeah, and Larry Snelling.
Yeah.
Saying, you know, property crime's down. No, it's not. Carjackings are up 40%. So you give yin to yang. I mean, it's still bad. It's not safe. No one feels safe in their neighborhood. It used to be certain neighborhoods. Now all 77 neighborhoods of Chicago have been touched by crime.
New York City is going so well. You have this story from Bloomberg. New York City's displaced Ukrainians weigh ditching the city for a war-torn home. Housing costs, crime, dwindling resources spur returns. Almost 80% of displaced Ukrainians dream of going home, like right now. Well, we saw the same thing here. Venezuelan migrants and others saying, I think we're going to go back. Chicago is, well, it was too cold, but
they were
also the same sort of thing. This is not the life of, this is not the land of milk and honey and the life of riches that we were promised by all of our Dem socialist political friends.
That's weird, because about 6 months ago, there was a similar story to a family in San Francisco, and the girl was so miserable. She was a senior in high school, and she begged her parents to go back because it was safer in Ukraine than San Francisco.
Carl in Northlake, you're on Chicago's Morning Answer.
Yeah, good morning. I'm chuckling at I'm going to comment on the basketball and the women and transgender thing, but I'm going to touch on the New York subway system. Yeah, their ridership's also down 40% from a few years ago. So, yeah, the same amount of crimes, you go per capita, it's probably up. But the more important thing, you know, this transgender and all this LGBT stuff, it's the shiny ball to keep us arguing as they steal our freedoms and rape the money system in America.
I don't think so. Thanks for the call, Carl. It's not a shiny ball. It's not a misdirection play. It's a direction play. Not a misdirection play, a direction play. Because to say it's a misdirection play is to suggest that it's not that important. It is important. The redefinition of man and woman is not important. See, this is where some conservatives just completely miss the game here, miss the progressive left's agenda and how methodical they are. It wasn't a big deal when we redefined
marriage.
Civil unions, that was stopped there. Wasn't a big deal when we destroyed marriage and we made marriage not marriage. And it wasn't a big deal. It's not a big deal. You know, you want to identify as this and I want to identify as that. Identify with as whatever you want. Okay. Because everything's equivalent. Oh, okay. Well, if everything's equivalent and I identify as something I'm not, well, then you have to recognize the thing. You have to recognize my identity, and now I want access because we've all agreed I can do whatever I want. So I want access to women's sports, for example, to keep it concrete. And nothing is ever a big deal culturally. And then we turn around and you talk about robbing our freedoms and our money. Well, right. Yeah, robbing our freedoms and our freedom to pursue our economic interests. And the two are not connected? Of course they are. Not a misdirection play, a direction play. Dan and Amy, Chicago's Morning Answer.
The stories you need to know to start your day. This is Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560. The Answer.
Business owners, now's the time for your business to make the move to a locally owned business bank. Hi, Mike Gallagher here to let you know that you don't have to look far. Signature Bank was founded in Chicago with a simple mission to help companies like yours grow, succeed, and thrive. Their decisions are made locally by a terrific team that knows your name, cares about your business, and invests in your success. That's why Signature Bank is my bank. I'm a customer. As business owners, they knew that local family-owned businesses were not getting the help they needed or deserved. So, I invite you to reach out to my friends at Signature Bank today. Write the number down. Remember this phone number, Signature Bank, 773-467-5630. And learn all about this great bank, 773-467-5630. Or visit them online at signaturebank.bank. That's signaturebank.bank. Signature Bank makes commercial banking personal. Member FDIC, Equal Housing Lender.
This is Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan Proft and Amy Jacobson on AM 560, The Answer.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy. We've sort of been talking about first hour. A recurring theme, which is the lack of courage to say what we know to be true on a range of topics. You know, America generally, when I say we, it's a virus in our body politic. And mentioning it, the coach of the South Carolina women's team didn't have the courage to say what she knows to be true about men playing women's sports. We're talking about the residents of major urban centers like Chicago who don't have the courage to admit or hold their political leaders accountable for not being willing to admit that they have lost control of their communities, that you have a public safety crisis in places like Chicago and New York City. Well, of course, this extends to what we know to be true about people entering this country illegally and doing so under this regime and complemented by the sanctuary city jurisdictions in waves, you know, heretofore unseen in America. So the response, and by the way, I just want to make this point because I didn't make courage, just to remember, you know, one of the great observations from C.S. Lewis about courage. So just and we're just talking about the courage to say what you know to be true. Courage is the formation of every virtue at its testing point. Courage is the formation of every virtue at its testing point. In other words, no courage, no virtue. You think you're a good person because you don't say what you know to be true? You need to inform your friends who fit that description that they are without virtue. It's impossible because they're without courage. Maybe that's a way to break through. I don't know. Some people are unreachable. I get it. So what we know to be true about what's happening with the indiscriminate entrance of people from all over the world. Carol Streamman, who was in the country illegally and had arrived from Mexico just weeks ago, is accused of murdering and nearly decapitating his wife. Yes. Carol Stream.
He was a stabby, if you want. And he did it right in front of his kids. He almost decapitated her. He'd stabbed her so much.
I see a statement from DuPage County State's Attorney about offering condolences to the surviving family. I see Carol Stream Police Chief Don Cummings commenting on this. Senseless and brutal act that removed the victim, Marciella, from the lives of her family, the children, but it has robbed two young children of their mother.
What aren't you seeing?
Where's the statement about this person being in the country illegally? Bob Berlin? Carol Stream Police Chief Don Cummings? Anybody? Anybody here in Illinois? Can they speak the truth about what's happening and why it's happening? Let me give you an example of what that looks like since we're so unfamiliar with it here. We'll have to go, you know, and this isn't going to, you know, one of the gunslingers from Florida. How about Butler County, Ohio?
Yeah, we talked about this a little on Friday, but they didn't know who the victim was at the time.
They know now.
Oh, no.
And Butler County, Ohio, the sheriff there, he's a gentleman named Richard Jones. Butler County, Ohio, Southwest Ohio, population about 400,000 people. He had a press conference, the sheriff did, at the county, Richard Jones. He had a press conference with the various aliases used in the various booking photos of this person who was deported 8 times and had been arrested 11 times, who has now been charged with murder. Deported 8 times, arrested 11 times. Picture of all of his aliases from all of his mugshots. And a couple of other poster boards at this press conference that Sheriff Richard Jones conducted. A picture of Joe Biden, a picture of Alejandro Mayorkas, and a picture of Mexican President AMLO. And here's what saying what we know to be true sounds like, since you never hear it from anyone in Chicagoland, at least not those in public offices.
How's everybody doing today? I'm Sheriff Richard of 24. He'd been in our jail 11 times. He had seven different names. He had three different birth dates. He'd been to prison 3 times. He's been deported 8 times. And what I said was, and he had over 20 charges in 20 years. And when you look at the pictures up here on the board, these are his mug shots. These are just the ones that we know of. So what I'm telling you today, when I had the press conference, I said our border is broken, and these two individuals are the cause of it. The third one is the president of Mexico, which he actually doesn't run Mexico. It's the drug cartel. And I told you that our border is broke. How does it affect Butler County, Ohio? We've had, and I said this in the past, I said we've had over 1,000 prisoners on state charges, not federal charges, state charges, in the Butler County Jail in Ohio, not on the Texas border, not on the Arizona border, in Butler County, Ohio. We border by water and by bridge, I believe it is, Canada, Ohio does. That's the northern border, and it's vulnerable at this point. But what I'm telling you is we've had roughly 1,000 prisoners in our jail in 3 years since Biden's been president. Of that, we've had at least 2,000 charges, state charges, on these 1,000 prisoners. The cost is roughly, to house these prisoners, $2 million. The court system and everything that goes with that, another $2 million. Butler County has had to pay $4 million in Ohio. And we're not the only one.
That's a lot of money.
Have you ever heard a breakdown like that from anybody in office in Chicagoland? I'm talking about Cook in the Collar Counties. A prosecutor, a sheriff, a state legislator, obviously not the governor, a mayor, a police chief. Why is it that no one can break this down the way that public officials in other states can break it down for their residents, their constituencies? Why is it that nobody in Cook and the Collar County seems to care very much about the absence of such a breakdown? Here's how much it costs. Here's what the open border means to DuPage County. Bob Berlin, James Mendrick, I don't know, a couple of the legislators that are left, Amy Grant. Here's what it means. And this is what the governor won't tell you. Oh, I know Bob Berlin's, you know, he can't hear me because his pee hat's on too tight because he's trying to do his little dance for reelection, and he doesn't want Jelly Belly Pritzker and his money to target him. Maybe if Bob Berlin had a little bit more courage, that he would get the kind of support that would make the Jelly Bellies and the Democrats targeting me in DuPage County irrelevant. And maybe it should be irrelevant regardless of whether he got support or not, because he's a prosecutor. Oh, I'm a prosecutor, not a politician. We hear that all the time. And then they get in office, and do they behave like prosecutors or politicians? A little bit of both. At best, in the best case scenario, it's a little bit of both. Why don't we get a breakdown? Here's what it means. Here's how much it costs. Here's how many people in this country illegally we've arrested. The charges in the aggregate and broken down. Don't you want to tell the stories of your constituents who've been victimized by people who shouldn't be in this country? Don't you want to tell the stories of your constituents who've been victimized, that people who shouldn't be on our streets, even if they're American citizens? Because that's obviously a part of the public safety conversation, too. Where do we get that in Chicagoland? Downstate's a bit of a different story. Where do we get that in Chicagoland? Can anybody give me a name? I'm talking about in public office with public safety responsibilities. Can anyone give me a name? Because I can't give you one.
312-642-5600, turnkey.pro answer line. You could also reach us on our text line, 64636. Type in DA, then a quick comment.
Corey Woodlawn, you're on Chicago's Morning Answer.
Morning, Dan and Amy. You say our system is broken, but I also say our citizens are broken. Yep. Where is our love for our country anymore? These people are getting on the phone telling their friends that we're stupid and ignorant and easy to be manipulated. 8 times? He's just giving them names, and he's pulling this stuff out of his hat. He doesn't care. And almost none of them have any respect for us. And we're letting these people in saying that they're going to be citizens? They must be crazy.
Well, I mean, Corey, why should they have respect for us? We don't have respect for ourselves. We let politicians behave the way I just described, And so why wouldn't we let other interlopers treat us the same way? That's what we like. That's what we want. We want to be openly mocked and disrespected while saying, if you don't indulge me, then you're not a good person. I'm a member of some oppressed class and so on and so forth. You know the rap as well as I do. But we have no respect for ourselves, which is why we don't stand up for ourselves for anything. Take my house, violate my daughters on an athletic field. I don't care.
Thomas Sowell has a great quote that says that, you know, the American spirit lives in our hearts. And when it dies, there's no constitution can resurrect it. I think the love for this country is dying, and it makes me so sad.
Thanks, Corey.
Thanks, guys.
But hey, the Archdiocese of Chicago stepping up, Cardinal Supich. He's not going to go to bat for kids on scholarship to get to better schools, mainly minority kids from mainly lower income families. Not going to go to bat for that.
No.
But the Archdiocese of Chicago is going to lease St. Bart's at no cost. That's my favorite kind of lease.
Right.
The no cost lease?
Or the one that's a dollar. Yeah.
Yeah.
Usually let me dig deep in my pocket.
Usually that's a sale.
Oh, okay.
You can buy for a dollar. You can lease for free if you're of the right political persuasion, if you have, you know, the right political capital associated with you.
Yeah, I heard so they're going to give them St. Bart's. That's on the northwest side, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. I'm sure the neighbors are going to love it. Don't worry. Your neighborhood won't end up looking like it did outside of Garfield Park.
I just wanted
they had 10,000 cigarette buds they picked up.
Right. I just wanted to make sure people were concerned that some of the people in this country and this city illegally were being, quote unquote, evicted from these makeshift shelters that BLM Brandon stood up. They're not going anywhere, as we told you. They're not going anywhere. So the Archdiocese is stepping in so you can move people around and pretend that they've got some kind of program and they've got some sort of standard that people have to abide. Yeah, none of that.
They're moving them out of the park districts and into that place and other places because summer's coming up, Dan. The kiddies need their spaces back all of a sudden.
Ron on Southside.
Dan and Amy. Dan, you would not hear that from them because they are despicable scumbag cowards. And I really totally despise Joe Biden. Period. Have a good day.
Okay.
I mean, duty of government is supposed to protect their citizens, and no one's doing that except for that sheriff in that county of Ohio.
Well, there are people around the country that are serious about this. There are people around Illinois that are serious about this too. They just don't live where 60% of the population lives. But that turns out to be a real weight on the rest of the state, and it turns out to be pretty dangerous environment for people who may otherwise be commonsensical and law-abiding and playing by the rules, but aren't up to speed with what's happening. But no, let's go to bat for fill-in-the-blank politician. I don't care if it's Republican or Democrat. Tell me again about the hills I'm supposed to die on for the politicians. Cook County said, we need Eileen Burke. We need Bob Berlin. We need this person. Why? Oh, I don't know. Just because the other person's worse. How do you know? How can you tell? Well, because I'm a Republican and they're a Democrat. Or because they're Irish versus black. Or because I know him or her and I don't know the other one. It's all just tribal bull jive. We need them. Sean and Darian.
Yeah, good morning, guys. Yeah, I know we're Berlin and Medrick, where they were at Chuck's Barbecue on Friday. Terry Newsom got me to run as precinct committeeman. All I need was 10 votes, you know, to try and oust some of these morons. And so we were supposed to go up there for a vote anyway, long story short. Yeah, those two guys are up there trying to play politics instead of doing, like you said, trying to keep these illegals out of this state, and it's pathetic. Thanks, guys.
Thanks for the call, Sean. Joe in Naperville.
Yeah, how could they come up with all this money out of the blue to take care of all these illegal immigrants, housing, health care, and everything, but they can't come up with money to get their cases adjudicated ASAP, where 87% of them fail to meet the standard of being able to be in this country.
Priorities. Yeah. Thanks for the call, Joe. Yeah. Priorities. Because, as we've said before, it's not an invasion, it's an importation. And if you understand that, you start, everything else starts to fall in line. Well, this makes sense. They're acting rationally. They want them here. They've invited them here. They're going to finance them to stay. Is that so complicated? Dave on 294.
Good morning. I see everything out here. I go into the industrial zones. I see who's working where. What's interesting, the manipulation of the taxpayer money to take care of people. And you take communities, 8, 9, 10,000 people, Iowa, Missouri, and they have material and plants, and they're making products, and they're getting undercut by plants and warehouses that have illegal help. So you're losing not just the jobs, but the communities are shutting down. You're losing the bakery. You're losing this store. You're losing the dollar value. And then when – I don't hate anybody. God bless everyone. But when you get people here that are sending money back home, that's money not spent in our communities. We should lock up Mayorkas, Joe Biden, and so many others for what they're doing.
Thanks for the call, Dave. Oh, and
trying to impeach Mayorkas.
Yeah, right.
It's not going anywhere. This week on Wednesday.
It's not going anywhere, I doubt. Yeah, and the other thing that happens is you create new sisterhoods. Sisterhoods of the getting pantsed, so to speak. Okay. Getting pantsed and getting sucker punched.
Oof.
Inside Edition. Has the story. Inside Edition
Inside
has the
Edition
story.
Of the women who were sucker punched in the face on the subway?
Yeah,
the
because the D.C. press corps doesn't have time to report on this.
What's your reaction to seeing that this is happening to other women?
It is actually so comforting just hearing each of your stories and say, okay, we felt this, but we can get through it. And we'll bring attention to it and help other women who are also struggling with this as well.
All these women, members of a sisterhood they never wanted to belong to.
No woman wants to feel scared walking down the street.
A woman on TikTok has been compiling all the recent videos of women who were sucker punched in New York. It's now up to 43.
Yeah, just women getting randomly punched in the face while they're walking down the street. I know. Big city living.
Listen to Dan and Amy on your smartphone. Download the AM560 mobile app today at 560theanswer.com/mobile. Only the biggest stories, only the biggest guests, and only the biggest opinions. This is AM560, The Answer.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy. Sway is a feeling. It's a vibe.
Ooh, sway.
It's the culmination of black and brown communities and LGBT communities coming together for cannabis.
Coming together for cannabis. Is that the slogan?
That's
fantastic.
That's what Edie Moore said. She's the co-owner of Sway.
Sway.
In the heart of Northside nightlife and culture. There will be a first in the history of Illinois. With bright colors and an array of lights, Sway will be the state's first all-minority LGBTQ-owned cannabis dispensary when it opens next week. All right.
Sway.
It's a new vibe in Chicago.
312-642-5600, turnkey.pro answer line. You could also reach us on our text line at 64636. Type in DA, then a quick comment. Yeah, because I remember all the dispensaries were open during COVID. But our churches were closed. That shows the direction our state is heading in.
The celebration of marijuana usage. It's a vibe. Being doped up is a vibe, is it? Is that what we say about booze, since the dope heads like to compare it to alcohol? Yeah, it's a vibe. Driving drunk, it's a vibe. Getting plastered and making an ass of yourself. It's just a new vibe, culture coming to the city. Is this positive? Is this positive culture? Because it's celebrated. Everybody should do it. Yeah. Sway, it's cool.
Sway.
The kids, get the kids involved. What's hip and cool and now, and you got the identitarian political piece to it on top of it.
mean, who's not going to go to Sway?
It's a new vibe. We see the same thing at, all over urban America. We got Weed Week, a kicking off event for Weed Week in San Francisco, as if that's much different than any other week. But it speaks to this celebratory aspect that I describe. London Breed is the mayor there, kicking off Weed Week.
Start with a quote from a famous group of San Francisco. Don't give me no Bammer weed. We don't smoke that in the SFC.
Don't give me no Bammer weed. We don't smoke that blank in the SFC. She is so street, London Breed. So cool. That's the vibe I'm talking about. That's the vibe that's coming to the north side and to all of Chicago.
She's so down with the struggle, I like to say.
London Breed, you know, and she's also just always, you know, tip of the spear when it comes to the music scene. Remember when she got caught violating her own mask mandate, but she used the Tony exception.
And I think it's sad that this is even a story. The fact is, there was something that was really monumental that occurred, and that is Tony, the original members, the brothers, Raphael Sadiq and Dwayne Wiggins, who have not performed in public for, I believe, at least over 20 years.
Oh my God.
They are just really some of the most incredible artists in the history of this country and the Bay Area in particular. And the fact that that is getting lost here is very unfortunate.
It feels good. And so does this Weed Week feel good. Tony has done it again. So Bammer weed, by the way, that we don't What's smoke that blank here.
What is that?
Bammer weed? Oh,
Bammer?
You don't know?
No, I hate pot. I can't stand it. I did it once and I almost called an ambulance on myself.
Yeah, unlike me, who's a pot junkie.
I've never
smoked weed either, but I know what Bammer weed is.
I don't know what it is.
It's crap marijuana. It's like all seeds and stems.
Oh.
So I understand. I try to stay hip with the kids like London Breed, the mayor of San Francisco, or Edie Moore, who's putting out a new vibe on the north side with Sway. Here's the London Breed reference, because it speaks to this high-minded culture that you certainly want to scale and extend, don't you? RBL Posse's song, Don't Give Me No Bammer Weed, was the reference, because RBL Posse is from SFC, like London Breed, man.
Don't give me no Bammer weed. We don't smoke that in the SFC. Don't give me no Bammer weed. We don't smoke that in the SFC. Don't give me no Bammer weed. We don't smoke that
catch it.
In the SFC. 3, 2, 1, coming in with the bangs. Two dark
skins.
Not a motherfucking bang. Pins with limbs, never know. You smoke, dang. Not the Bammer. Damn, that Bammer ain't no good. You might as well smoke some rolled up wood. And you laugh and said those lines was funny. But trip on the sense that I'm stressed, your punk.
Yeah, there's a lot of use of the N-word and stuff, because London Breed likes Tony, but she also loves the gangsta rap. Oh, by the way, RBL Posse had three original members, one of whom is still alive. What a great culture, these urban cultures.
Well, let's celebrate them.
I want to talk about another vibe shift, since it's not going on in Chicago, it's not going on in San Francisco, but it's going on elsewhere. David in Winnetka, you're on Chicago's Morning Answer.
Hey, good morning, guys. Thanks for taking my call. You know, speaking to weed, I myself personally, I don't have anything against it, and whatever. I had just hadn't smoked in about 10 years, but about 6 months ago, I got displaced. I was displaced, and I was staying in a hotel, and started hanging out with a group of people that, you know, everybody, you know, a joint came out and started coming around, and I didn't want to be that white square dude.
What, the city council?
Yeah. And, first and foremost, my God, is this so strong nowadays? I have no. They gave me some rapper weed, and I wasn't ready. Like Dave Chappelle, But I continued to smoke. And, I just looked at my life. I was going down, made a list last night. And I'm like, my God, everything has all of a sudden just taken a turn for the worse. And it's directly involved with smoking weed, being lazy, lethargic. You just stop giving a damn about anything. And so, you know, you can definitely see that, especially in our Blue Run cities, that was a huge catalyst to part of, the problem with what's going on. Thanks so much, guys.
Thanks, Dave. Yeah, why don't we celebrate being too drunk to go to work? Too drunk to abide your responsibilities? I mean, if we're going to compare it, you know, for the marijuana enthusiasts, if we're going to compare it. Another vibe that's considerably more productive, and since we've been talking about the other side of this all morning, this op-ed by Santiago Pelego has gotten a lot of play. In fact, Tucker Carlson interviewed the author, Santiago Pelego. Yeah, it's called Vibe Shift. Here's what he's talking about. He's not talking about sway on the north side and the LGBT and black and brown communities coming together for cannabis. That's the most productive. That's the most productive thing to come around together around, right?
Yeah, we're going
to
celebrate it.
Public safety, kids' education. No, dope. Sure. Okay. The vibe shift that Pelago writes about is speaking previously unspeakable truths. The noticing of previously suppressed facts. I'm talking about the give you feel when the walls of propaganda and bureaucracy start to move as you push. The very visible dust kicked up in the air as experts and fact checkers scramble to hold on to decaying institutions. The cautious but electric rush of energy when dictatorial edifices designed to stifle innovation, enterprise, and thought are exposed or toppled. Fundamentally, the vibe shift is a return to really a championing of reality. A rejection of the bureaucratic, the cowardly, the guilt-driven. A return to greatness, courage, and joyous ambition. Do you think that's going on? Do you see evidence of this vibe shift that Santiago Pelago writes about? 312-642-5600, turnkey.pro answer line. He talks about how much Elon Musk's purchase of Twitter accelerated this. Because you had an outlet where you could speak your piece now you do, and you weren't going to be, canceled. He goes on, just a little bit more color on the vibe shift he's talking about. See if you see evidence of this in your world. Be interested to hear. The old ways of cutting and slicing the world have been broken down, and now the most unexpected groups have found themselves as co-belligerents in an existential war to preserve our ability to speak, compute, build, worship, transact, and to live in peace. And thus we get the vibe shift. The vibe shift looks like ditching childless civilizational nihilism and saying, yeah, having kids is actually good. The vibe shift is the repudiation of homogenizing hyper-globalism and instead intentionally pursuing the communal, the local, and the national. The vibe shift is the rejection of reality denial and instead embracing that men and women are unique and different. The vibe shift is the refusal to subordinate yourself to your family, yourself and your family, to the whims and anxieties of activists and bureaucrats, and relearning to trust your eyes and ears. The vibe shift is the rejection of secular liberal materialism and a return to the Christian foundations of the West. The vibe shift is taking off the ironic veil that aims to cover the festering wounds of despair and putting on the vestments of seriousness instead. The vibe shift is laughing at those trying to demonize men and cheerfully proclaiming dudes rock. The vibe shift is spurning the fake and the therapeutic and reclaiming the authentic and the concrete. The vibe shift is a healthy suspicion of credentialism and a return to human judgment. The vibe shift is living not by lies and instead speaking the truth, whatever the cost. The vibe shift is directly facing our tumultuous times, refusing to blackpill and choosing to build instead. There is no denying that whatever else, the vibe shift is an electric time. After all, things hidden before the foundation of the world are being rediscovered, and things thought to last until the end of time are crumbling at hypersonic speeds. How long the vibe shift lasts remains to be seen. It may be fleeting, though I hope it sticks around. However long it lasts, we must steward it. So I guess there's a couple different vibe shifts from which to select. The vibe shift of being another shiftless dope head, or the vibe shift that Santiago Pelego writes about.
It's what Chicago is talking about. It's Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan and Amy on AM 560, The Answer. This is Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan Proft and Amy Jacobson on AM 560, The Answer.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy. So it's 6 months since the October 7th attack, terrorist attack by Hamas in Gaza.
It feels like 5 to 10 years, doesn't it? I mean, 6 months, I was surprised that it's, I don't know, lasted this long.
There's been a lot of activity, war, packed into those 6 months, no question. And the 6 month mark was the occasion for the Biden administration, through its spokeshumans like NSC spokesman John Kirby, to take a harder line against Bibi and the State of Israel in terms of its response to that terrorist attack, its efforts to eradicate Hamas. We note over the weekend that the IDF, Israeli Defense Forces, withdrew nearly all their troops from southern Gaza. I guess this is in anticipation of peace and ceasefire talks that are to take place again in Egypt. We'll get more color on that from our next guest, Stephen Bucci, in a moment. But here's what Kirby had to say on Face the Nation as to the question of conditioning continued support in the terms of military aid to Israel on Bibi paying more attention to what Biden is saying.
Is the Biden administration position still that there should be zero conditions on aid, military aid to Israel?
I'm not going to get ahead of the president or decisions he might or might not make going forward. He was very clear in his call with the prime minister that if we don't see some changes in their policies in Gaza and the way they're prosecuting operations, we're going to have to make some changes of our own.
You do think these are Israeli policies, then, to block aid?
They get to decide how they prosecute this war. It's their operation. We just talked about them pulling troops out and what that means. They get to decide how they prosecute operations. We get to decide how we're going to react to that and how we're going to administer our own policy with respect to Gaza. We make those decisions. And the president was clear with the prime minister. If there's not changes, if things don't get better, then we're going to have to make changes of our own.
Things don't get better.
What does better look like?
Interesting phrase. Now, concurrent to that sort of rhetoric was this sort of rhetoric, because it was international Al-Quds Day, and there were rallies among the Arab population, Arab American population around the country, and of course in Dearborn, Michigan, which has a sizable Arab American population.
Yeah, they're chanting "Death to America, Death to Israel." Mm-hmm.
Yeah, on Quds Day, which is to commemorate opposition to Israelis, quote unquote, occupation of Palestine. That's the purpose of the day and the rallies, the quote unquote occupation. I say that with quotation marks because that's a false allegation. Give you an example of what you're dealing with and who the Biden administration is pandering to. Hamas enthusiasts like this activist named Tariq Bazzi, who had this to say on Quds Day, the Quds Day rally in Dearborn, Michigan.
We've been asked in the past, why are our protests on the International Day of Quds, why are they so anti-America? Why don't we just focus more on Israel and not talk so much about America? Gaza has shown the entire world why these protests are so anti-America. Because it's the United States government that provides the funds for all of the atrocities that we just heard about. And this is why Imam Khomeini, who declared the International Day of Quds, this is why he would say to pour all of your chants and all of your shouts upon the head of America. Malcolm X said, and I quote, "We live in one of the rottenest countries that has ever existed on this earth. It's not Genocide Joe that has to go. It's the entire system that has to go. Any system that would allow such atrocities and such devilry to happen and would support it, such a system does not deserve to exist on God's earth." And so when these fools ask us if Israel has the right to exist, the chant "Death to Israel" has become the most logical chant shouted across the world today.
Seems like a reasonable chap.
Oh, yeah.
His comrades there, "Death to America, death to Israel," is what they were chanting at his beckoning.
If they hate America so much, why don't they leave?
Probably because he's a tenured professor at Michigan University or something. University of Michigan, maybe Michigan State.
Who knows, yeah.
Following Tariq Bazzi, next up on the hit list was Michigan imam Usama Abdul Ghani. He feels about the same way.
Imam Khomeini recognized that Israel is an evil settler colonialist project. He realized it is a cancer, and he established this day. Israel, before this, brothers and sisters, was a sacred cow. Nobody could criticize Israel. Everybody was terrified of being anti-Semitic. Everybody was afraid of them. But now, the people of conscience very openly will criticize Israel. They recognize Israel for what it is. Israel is ISIS. They are Nazis. They are fascists. They are racist. The people of the world now know this.
Free Palestine!
Yeah, right.
Like little kids up there saying,
yeah.
Free Palestine. Because it's so cute when the kiddies do it.
Little kids, members of Congress like Rashida Tlaib, who can tell the difference? So that's who the Biden administration wants to appease by taking a rhetorically a hard line against our most important ally in the Middle East. Interesting. For more on this, we're pleased to be joined by Stephen Bucci, who is, he served America for 3 decades as an Army Special Forces officer and top Pentagon official. He's a visiting fellow in the Heritage Foundation's Allison Center for Foreign Policy Studies. Steve Bucci, thanks for joining us. Appreciate it.
It is my pleasure. I'm always happy to be on the show.
So, This ratcheting up of the rhetoric from John Kirby and others in the direction of Israel after those aid workers were inadvertently killed. What do you anticipate Bibi's reaction will be as he's facing some protests at home as well? And how should we understand this at least temporary withdrawal of Israeli defense forces from southern Gaza?
Well, I'll start with that last part first. The movement of the troops in Israel by the Israelis makes perfect sense. I don't know, when did that unit go in? Was that the first unit that went into Gaza? So now they're pulling them out to give them a little rest, because after 6 months of intense urban terrain fighting, they probably need a break. I wouldn't read too much into the movement of those particular troops. That's a tactical level decision, probably made by the Israeli military and not necessarily by Netanyahu himself. With regard to what Netanyahu is going to do based on this phone call, the Biden administration is pandering to the demographic that you identified there, these folks who had this rally and others in the country. Most of them are wildly inaccurate with their history and even their political analysis as far as how deep that kind of feeling goes in this country, how deep it goes in other countries. I think it's ludicrous for supporters of Hamas to claim genocide against anybody else in the world, including Israel. I love when people do this, like Hamas. They go and kick over the hornet's nest, and when they get stung, it's the hornet's fault.
Right.
It's nutty. And now you have, I believe, Sunni Arab American people in Michigan quoting the Shia imam from Tehran, who, by the way, thinks they are not even Muslims, would be happy to persecute them if they were in his country. And then to, you know, sit there and say this is the worst country in the world. Everybody knows that now. First of all, we're not the only country that supports Israel. We are probably their biggest supporter, no doubt. But that's because Israel has been our biggest supporter in the Middle East. So it's kind of, it's a dangerous one because there are people who are radicalized in that community. Not all of them. The unfortunate of the 100,000 live there, there's at least 4 to 5% adequately radicalized that they might take action here in the United States.
Well, what do you think, John? What do you think John Kirby means when he says, if there's not changes, then we're going to have to make changes of our own? What does that look like?
Well, it's a veiled threat that, the Netanyahu administration doesn't do exactly what Biden may have demanded of them in their recent phone call, that they're going to cut off. I mean, that's the veiled threat. And that sovereign actions of another sovereign nation and says, okay, you can do whatever you want. That's your country. But if you do certain things, we change the way we interact with you.
Hey, John, you're cutting out a little bit, too. Do you have a, are you in a bad spot, cell spot?
No, I'm sitting in place. How's this?
Hmm.
Can you hear me?
Yeah, okay.
Yeah.
We'll try that.
Okay. By academia, that means what he said is untrue. Politically, I don't think Biden's he's losing a lot of support anyway among Democrats because a lot of Democrats do support Israel. And to pander to that one relatively small demographic there in Dearborn and a couple other pockets around the country, and maybe some kids on a college campus or so, to suddenly cut aid to Israel, I think would be a death knell to Biden. I think if he significantly changes our degree of aid to Israel, it will have enormous ramifications negatively for Biden. So I don't think he'll do it. He didn't have the courage to do it.
Well, these guys, I mean, it's always, do just enough to keep up appearances, but not enough, or don't allow somebody, don't go along with somebody who is willing to do enough to actually win a particular fight. And so we see the same thing happening in Ukraine. And it's so funny, too, because all this high-minded rhetoric of righteous causes and we're doing this because it's the right thing to do and we're preserving democracy and we're repelling a dictator, a revanchist dictator in Putin and so on and so forth. And then you hear, according to the Financial Times, Biden administration urging Ukraine to halt its campaign targeting Russian refineries, warning that the drone strikes risk driving up global oil prices and provoking retaliation. Oh, now all of a sudden there's political political considerations like the price at the pump here in America that Biden is worried about because he's hamstrung our domestic oil production and he doesn't want the cost of global oil to increase because since we're an importer again, that would be bad for his reelection chances come November. So there's the pandering on the one side to a sensitive constituency that is infiltrated by all sorts of illiberal Islamo-fascist nutcases, including members of Congress. And then there's this other side where Ukraine. We have to do whatever, anything it takes, whatever. We got to stop. And it's but hey, don't get too aggressive with this worst dictator in the world kind of thing is the rhetoric. Because, you know, I still got to make sure that people don't take it in the shorts at the pump.
Yeah, it is kind of you sit there and shake your head that, you know, Biden loves to take so-called moral stands, but he doesn't have the stomach to back it up with the action necessary or to pay the price that's required. And I'm not talking about sending American troops or anything else. Heck, just keep giving them rhetorical support to the good guys would be helpful. But he literally is a political weather vane, whichever way the wind blows. And frankly, it's not even the majority wind. They're little puffs of wind from spots around the country or around the world or particular political positions. And this is one of the worst politicized in the sense of swinging back and forth, depending on the headlines of the day. Administrations I've ever seen. I mean, it happens all the time. This kind of stuff is always has political tinges to it. But boy, with the Biden administration, it's kind of over the top and embarrassing. Our adversaries overseas have got to be sitting there going, yeah, this is really entertaining watching this guy twist himself and the United States into pretzels. It's just embarrassing, frankly.
Stephen Bucci served America for 3 decades as Army Special Forces officer and top Pentagon official, now a visiting fellow in the Heritage Foundation's Allison Center for Foreign Policy Studies. Stephen Bucci, thank you as always.
It's my pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Thank you. And he joined us on our turnkey.pro answer line.
Connect with Dan and Amy using the AM560 mobile app. Download it today at 560theanswer.com/mobile. If you're looking for the latest news, insight into what it means, and the sharpest opinion, there's only one station in Chicago where you can turn, and it's this one. We're AM 560, The Answer.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy. Since we desire to live in a peaceful, pluralist society, we're always looking for indications of peaceful pluralism on college campuses. They're more difficult to find than they used to be. So we've talked about the new School of Civic Life that is being stood up at University of North Carolina, what Ben Sasse is doing at University of Florida, the founding of this University of Austin that's in development, many other such examples, places like Hillsdale, the offerings and the approach at Hillsdale College and elsewhere, which is why when this piece appeared in Boston Magazine a couple of weeks ago, we discussed it. This concept that a popular poli-sci professor at Tufts University, one of those elite universities, this idea that he had to offer a class in conservative thought, the idea that conservative thinkers, conservative thinkers at equally elite universities, like our friend Glenn Lowry at Brown University, that their thinking and work product should be considered is a foreign concept at so many of these places, which is why it generated the interest it did, I guess, from Boston Magazine and certainly for me. The course on conservative thought presents undergrads at Tufts with a range of conservative thinking from the Book of Genesis forward, covers a lot of ground in a hurry, for consideration. And it doesn't do the point counterpoint, as I understand it from the piece in Boston Magazine, because obviously you can get the counterpoint in virtually every other class. So what was the basis of said experiment and how's it going so far? For more on this, we're pleased to be joined by the professor, Eitan Hirsch. He's the professor of poli-sci I mentioned at Tufts. Professor Hirsch, thanks for joining us. Appreciate it.
Yeah, my pleasure. Thanks for having me.
So the conception behind it, why challenge students with this very directed course on conservative thought?
Well, I mean, you know, just kind of like you said, it makes people smarter if they know
how to think about things from different points of view. And most of the students here are coming from a very, very progressive point of view. And so, you know, I think they'd be interested. They generally don't get to have open conversations about topics related to religion, family, crime, all the subjects that are part of a national conversation. But I think that conversation is often stifled if they can't talk openly about different perspectives from their own, particularly from conservative perspectives. And so that was one motivation. And the other big one is that there are, you know, opportunities to learn about kind of the history of conservative thought, but not a lot to think about really contemporary issues in politics. And so that was the focus of the class.
Well, that stifling you mentioned is, of course, purposeful. So how did your colleagues in the poli sci department or on campus generally react to this course you created?
Yeah, I mean, I think so far I've had very positive reactions. You know, I think that to the extent that there's not a lot of conservative ideas on campus, it's all very subtle. It's like, you know, who's hired, who's not hired, what topics of research people find, you know, hiring committees find interesting versus what they don't find interesting. And so it's not like anyone said, don't teach the class. It's just that, you know, at some point I realized that this class should be taught and there's no one else to teach it but me. So I think that the reasons why universities like this one tend to be so homogenous are pretty complicated. It has to do with, you know, what students are recruited, what kind of signals this school sends about what kind of school it is and what kind of students it wants. And same with faculty and staff. So it's not like we want you to teach this class or not teach that class. It's just sort of the whole groundwork is established so that this kind of class doesn't usually emerge.
So during this 13-week class, do you offer liberal rebuttals to conservative thoughts?
Well, I mean, I kind of present there's, we want to cover a lot of ground. I mean, it's mostly public policy focused, and I really want the students to be exposed to what the conservative perspectives are, because those are really new to them. Most of the students in the class tend to be liberal. Not all. I mean, I think it's probably the most ideologically diverse room on campus, at least the most ideological one that's talking about politics. I would guess like the engineering classes are probably actually more diverse, but they don't talk about politics. So the students, I think, can access their basic sense of what the liberal or progressive view is on all these items. In fact, on many topics like affirmative action or crime or religion, they've also learned a sort of a left leaning mindset in other courses.
So, what was surprising to you about the students' reactions as the semester wore on?
Well, I mean, it's always interesting to learn what topics students find interesting. You know, I thought that the classes on family and religion really felt quite new to the students and also quite personal. I mean, they haven't necessarily thought about what role religion has in their own lives or in what it does to benefit American society, what kind of structured families do for the benefit of mothers and fathers and of children. And so I think they were all kind of that topic felt like illicit, like they, you know, oh, we're not supposed to talk about this stuff, but they wanted to, and they were interested in it. And they're interested in family dynamics as they vary by economic standing. You know, most of the students here come from quite well-to-do families, and they've had really stable upbringings. And when they learn that, you know, a lot of people, particularly who haven't had college education, you know, there's really been this tremendous breakdown of family structure. The students are interested to know why and what role public policy has had in the decline of family units. So that's just one topic, but I think it was a topic that was particularly interesting to students.
And were they more open-minded than you expected they'd be? I mean, from reading the piece, it seems like they present as like not liking people being shouted down who have opposing views, and there's ways to express your views while being respectful of people who have different views. I mean, that's some of what was highlighted in the piece, and that would, you know, in normal times, I would say that would be rather unremarkable, but these don't seem to be very normal times, particularly on college campuses where that is more routine, even if it's not always necessarily representative of the student body as a whole. So is that a fair characterization of their general attitude, that if somebody was pro-life, they'd listen to hear him out, how whatever his or her religious views and understanding of the respect for life where that comes from, and so on and so forth, and let people finish their thought, and let's respond on point, let's avoid some of the ad hominem, those sorts of things. Is that a fair characterization of that environment?
Yeah, I mean, it's funny because this class is like a bubble inside a bubble, right? So, I mean, the big secret of the class is that it selects for like the smartest kids in the school who want to actually engage with the debate and learn about difference.
Right.
You know, so you have these really great students, and I think what they're realizing in the class is that much of the rest of their life on campus operates in this kind of toxic world of shutting people down who are different. You know, we can't let a pro-life position be articulated on campus. And then, you know, you sit in the conversation in class and you actually learn that you can have a really normal conversation about this stuff. I mean, you know, the TA for my class was the president of the Harvard Law School's Federalist Society, you know, and the students learn from him that, like, you know, oh, my TA can be just like a really nice, smart guy who gives me good feedback on my essays. And he happens to be a conservative. And like, you know, that's new to some of these students. So, yeah, I mean, I think we are in this bubble, but sometimes particularly with the issue of Israel-Palestine that came up in the semester, and that was written about in that Boston Magazine article,
right?
You know, there are tensions, and, you know, our job here is to help students work through that.
Yeah, was that the most contentious issue that was tackled in the semester?
Yeah, I mean, obviously, I didn't know it was going to be before the semester
right.
started. You know, I thought probably like trans education or something would be the most controversial. But yeah, I mean, the issue was very hot. You know, it was also very personal for me, so it was just like a very difficult week or two at the beginning of that. And then we saw that, you know, we have on this campus, like many other campuses, essentially like a pro Hamas, pro terrorist subset of students, and so. For many people on campus, they weren't aware that there is such a, you know, that there is such an extreme position articulated publicly.
Well, do you have any Jewish students, and how'd they feel about that?
Yeah, I mean, there were students just, you know, crying in their seats basically that first week when we were talking about this, and when there emerged, you know, on campus this, you know, right after the terrorist attack on October 7th, we had this student group that was, you know, celebrating basically, you know, they were celebrating the creative strategies they said used by Hamas. And, you know, that student group has been prominent on campus ever since.
Yeah. And not just at Tufts, as we know. How did they react to what transpired in the Ivy League after the congressional testimony of the Claudine Gays of the world?
Yeah. I mean, I think it's interesting because the same dynamics or the same tensions are here at Tufts as at those other schools. Tufts has the blessing of being, blessing and curse of being like less prominent than Harvard. So it doesn't have the same attention from the public, but you know, the dynamics are all the same. You have these same kinds of tensions between which communities the school leadership, you know, will bend over backwards to support and which one's not, and you know, where that comes from and how it gets navigated, not just among the leaders of the schools, but along low-level staff and faculty. So it's, you know, I think it has the same complexities as the other universities, but without the same PR.
Yeah, right. What about their disposition towards America generally? And did you see that change at all over the course of the class? I mean, I think about it just in terms of race relations to use an example. So obviously you have somebody like Glenn Lowry, I mentioned at the outset, who's in his 70s. He lived through Jim Crow. He lived through this, and he was involved in the civil rights era, the politics of the civil rights era. He was left and he moved. So he has some standing to talk about these issues, but then also put them in the context of sort of the larger ideals of America, the American experiment, if you will. And I wonder if maybe some light bulbs went off about, you know, America as this imperfect place because it's filled with imperfect human beings. But in terms of the founding principles, the ideas, the aspirations, this is something that shouldn't be discarded so as easily as some might suggest it should.
Yeah, you know, that's a great point. I mean, I'm really a scholar of American politics, and so one of my weaknesses in teaching is I don't really know much about other countries. So I don't really focus too much on American exceptionalism. But what I would say is that exposing students to, say, like, you know, a number of Black conservative thinkers over history is very enlightening, because I think a lot of students have read a lot of perspectives that make them think that there is not that diversity of view, say, within the Black community. So, you know, one of the early readings I assigned them, and this is just such a great thing for if your listeners are interested. Most of the students have heard of Zora Neale Hurston. There's a book called Their Eyes Are Watching God that's very commonly taught in high schools. But what most people don't know is that, you know, she was like a real conservative against, mm-hmm. you know, a Black American, against Brown v. Board of Education, against the New Deal, and really against communism and bristled at the idea that African American community would support Russia in the communist era. So, you know, I sign pieces like that, and the students are really exposed to that. There are a lot of different views here, and I think that is inspiring, because you know, it's just like, it's nice to see that there are different perspectives.
And the course is going to continue.
Yeah, next fall.
All right.
I want to sign up.
Very good. Yeah, you're going to have some adults, I think, that want to come and audit the class, right?
Via Zoom.
Ayton Hirsch, Professor Poli Sci at Tufts University, thanks so much for joining us. Appreciate it.
My pleasure. Anytime. Take care.
Thank you. And he joined us on our turnkey.pro answer line.
The more you listen, the more you listen, the more you'll know. This is Chicago's Morning Answer. Morning Answer. On AM 560, The Answer. This is Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan Proft and Amy Jacobson on AM 560, The Answer.
There's nothing I can do, a total eclipse of the heart.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy. This solar eclipse stuff is so bizarre to me, but I love the phraseology.
What?
The Path of Totality.
Well, that was the name of your elementary school band.
Yeah, it was. My junior high school years.
Oh, okay.
It was a Trail of Dead tribute band, for those who were hip like me at the time and knew about the alt rock scene in Austin, Texas.
So you're not going to get your glasses or even look at the. It's not going to happen again until 2044.
Yeah, I'm going to drive 6 hours for something that may or may not last 4 minutes, depending on the cloud cover. Makes sense. Sounds like a life that's chock full of activity.
Well, some of our listeners are there, like Bob from Buffalo Grove. He drove down with his wife, and they rented a Airbnb or got a hotel room or something.
Right, because it's been, you know, almost 7 years since the last one.
I remember the last one was cool. Did you see the last one?
No.
It was in 2017.
I saw pictures. That's good enough.
And we were at Great American. It got dark for a few minutes, and then it slowly became light. But it was kind of hazy that day, so I'm looking forward to today.
Yeah, well, please do tomorrow. Weirdos. I can't wait to hear of the harrowing stories of trekking down to Southern Illinois or Southern Indiana to experience those 4 minutes of zen.
Well, you're going to be on a plane, so, you know. If the world ends, because some people are conspiracy theorists, say that this is going to be the end of the world.
I'm rooting for it. I hope so.
Yeah. Well, the first plane that's going down when the electricity goes off and the grid goes off.
Yeah. I think I'll be on the ground before the moment of truth. But anyway. All right. We have to talk about President Trump, his much anticipated commentary, position staking on abortion, because, of course, this is potentially one of the pitfalls for his candidacy and Republicans up and down the ballot across the country. There's concern that the Dems will be able to do what they've done the last couple of cycles, which is to animate urban and suburban pea hats to vote this issue in exclusion of any other. So what's he going to do? What does the Republican Party do? How do you get in front of this issue rather than rather than being in a defensive posture where so many Republicans and conservatives are on the life issue. Here's the message that Trump posted to Truth Social, staking out his view and one I presume he hopes Republicans up and down said ballot across said country adopt.
By leadership, the Republican Party will always support the creation of strong, thriving, and healthy American families. We want to make it easier for mothers and families to have babies, not harder. That includes supporting the availability of fertility treatments like IVF in every state in America. Like the overwhelming majority of Americans, including the vast majority of Republicans, conservatives, Christians, and pro-life Americans, I strongly support the availability of IVF for couples who are trying to have a precious baby. What could be more beautiful or better than that? Today, I'm pleased that the Alabama legislature has acted very quickly and passed legislation that preserves the availability of IVF in Alabama. They really did a great and fast job. The Republican Party should always be on the side of the miracle of life and the side of mothers, father, their beautiful babies, and that's what we are. IVF is an important part of that, and our great Republican Party will always be with you in your quest for the ultimate joy in life. Many people have asked me what my position is on abortion and abortion rights, especially since I was proudly the person responsible for the ending of something that all legal scholars, both sides, wanted and, in fact, demanded be ended. Roe v. Wade. They wanted it ended. It must be remembered that the Democrats are the radical ones on this position because they support abortion up to and even beyond the ninth month. The concept of having an abortion in the later months and even execution after birth, and that's exactly what it is, the baby is born, the baby is executed after birth, is unacceptable, and almost everyone agrees with that. My view is now that we have abortion where everybody wanted it from a legal standpoint, the states will determine by vote or legislation or perhaps both. And whatever they decide must be the law of the land. In this case, the law of the state. Many states.
So there's the big takeaway. It was overturned, that being Roe. It was returned to the states. That's what pro-lifers wanted. And so it's up to the individual states to fight it out, hearts and minds, as well as politically at the state and local level. Subsidiary power closest to the people. And, of course, this, not surprisingly, a statement of support for IVF, which also has conservatives jumpy because the left thought this was an opportunity per that Alabama brouhaha to leverage more hysteria among the pro-abortion set. 312-642-5600, turnkey.pro answer line, 64636-DA, turnkey.pro text line. Is that a satisfactory message? Is that a politically astute position that Trump has taken? Is that one you think the Republican Party should adopt, in toto, writ large, across the country?
I don't know. What do you think? Did you like?
I asked you first.
Well, the only thing, you know, I wasn't surprised by anything that he said. The only thing that kind of stuck out was when he said, the Democrats say that this is a lie, that they're going to execute the baby they want to a day after it's born. And I don't know if that's executing the baby after birth. He said that that's, he brought that up in his statement.
Well, you had Ralph Northam, the former governor of Virginia, who said if a baby is born alive after a botched abortion, then we have a conversation about its future. So that's a pretty concrete example of what he's speaking of. There's no doubt that the position on the left is, the pro-abortion left, is pro-abortion, which is abortion all day, every day, all the time, at taxpayer expense, without parental consent. Involvement, mm-hmm. Consent, notification, involvement. So that's the left's position, and you do have to characterize accurately your opponent's position, and that is their position. There are no exceptions. There are no exceptions that they tolerate. There are no restrictions that they tolerate. This is very clear. So that's one thing. The question is, what is the GOP's response? And now you have the GOP presidential nominee's response. Should that be the party's position writ large, should is Trump striking the right balance, if you will, on the issue, such that it rounds off the edges as a political weapon for the left? That's the question, isn't it?
Or does some Republicans want a federal ban on abortion?
Well, some obviously
weeks
do,
or
but
15
but,
weeks, they want weeks set. Some parameters put in place.
Some obviously do. They've proposed it, but that's not so. Okay, but the question is Trump's position. What's your assessment of Trump's position since he's the standard bearer for the party for president of the United States?
I think his message was spot on. And he brought up, you know, Ronald Reagan, I'm strongly in favor of exceptions for rape, incest, and life of the mother.
A life of the mother is not an exception. I don't know why this has been so difficult to understand. The pro-life position is that the doctor acts to preserve life. So life of the mother is not an exception. It's acting in preservation of life, which is consistent with the life position. It's just something people say because, of course, they don't think through any of these issues. They just repeat what somebody else has said.
Huh. And Trump did that by repeating what Ronald Reagan said this morning.
Well, he characterized what Ronald Reagan's position. That's not the same thing as repeating it. Kevin in Austin, Texas, you're on Chicago's Morning Answer.
Good morning, Dan. Good morning, Amy. I think it's brilliant. It takes it off the as far as the federal level on that election. It's a sound of one hand clapping. No, you guys figure it out. You guys can argue for abortion at the state level. We're going to stay out of it. I think it's what you have to do. And then just one comment on the eclipse thing. I mean, down in Austin, Texas, I was annoyed because it took me an extra hour to get a table for brunch on Sunday.
Yeah, anyhow, that is annoying.
Real inconveniences.
Thanks for the call, Kevin. Mary Kay, Western Springs.
Hi, you guys. Yeah, I don't care about this eclipse thing either. I mean, I'm busy doing other things, so big deal. Anyway, I had a conversation with someone I was trying to get to sign that the Parents Matter petition the other day, and I used abortion as an example, saying, you know, I don't want anyone, I would never want anyone to escort my child to get an abortion without me knowing about it. Her response is, well, there are a lot of bad parents out there.
Yep.
And I said, so what does that mean? You know, so there are bad parents out there, and you're saying that if they have to have consent, that kid might go home and get the beat out of them because they're pregnant.
So are we still on the public airways? Do we still have an FCC license? Do we have an FCC license? Yeah. Okay. Stuff kicked out of them. Okay. Now keep it
right
inside
the
lines.
Because I'm upset always when I talk about this.
Yeah.
But mm-hmm. I said, well, people still suffer medical consequences for having these procedures. You know, you don't know what an abortion does to the inside of a woman's uterus or the anything down there. You know, they could suffer from something in the future that might make them infertile in the future. I mean, that really happens. And she said, well, I don't want my kid going into an alley and sticking a hanger up there. And I said, well, does that still happen? And she said, well, you don't know. And I said, well, do people still die after having medical procedures? I said, that definitely happens.
Well,
if a kid is being escorted by a friend. Mm. Well, I mean, but Dan, there are consequences for every,
I'm aware of all this. So when you're talking to somebody who is just repeating the same nonsense that Planned Parenthood has been saying for 50 years, you say something like, so if your unescorted daughter went to get an abortion, so that's an invasive surgical procedure. Would you agree that's an invasive surgical procedure? Yeah, I think that's a starting point. Okay, so would you want that surgical center that she's going to, let's call it a surgical center, let's be generous.
Yeah.
Would you want that surgical center that she is going to be, you know, regulated and licensed by the state such that you know that it is clean, a clean and safe environment for her? And she would say, and that person will say yes. And that, and then you say, well, then why don't you want abortion mills regulated by the state? Because they're not. The one surgical center, the one surgical environment where people do invasive surgeries that is unregulated by the state of Illinois and in other pro-abortion states, And this is how you get a situation like Gosnell in Philadelphia, where he was running this chop shop that endangered and killed women, and which is why he's spending the rest of his life in prison. So, you know, maybe Mrs. whoever you were talking to, maybe you want to inform yourself a little bit more about this issue beyond the tire talking points and boogeymen that have been created by Planned Parenthood before you come down on against good parents who want to know when their child is going under the knife. You knucklehead ghoul.
Exactly. Yeah. This is why I call you, Dan, because you always give me the right, the next right thing to say. I get so upset during these conversations.
Don't get upset.
Because I'm emotional. And so if I call you and you tell me, then this is what I'll do today. The next time someone comes up against me, very good.
Yeah. And but you probably don't want to call her a knucklehead ghoul. No. Like
I won't call her a knucklehead ghoul, but you know what? I'm losing friends and neighbors left and right, and I could care less.
Oh yeah, I
don't
agree.
Care. I just don't care anymore. I'm like, I live in some la la land over here where there's a lot of little, the people think they're so big in this little town. It's like, you're a big fish in a town of 11,000. You're nothing. Yeah. You make no difference in the world. You're doing nothing but living in your own little freaking world bubble over here. And you can't think past your foot, and you're not going to. I just have to, I suppose, accept it and move to a red state where I'm more with people who, you know, think like me, because it's just not, it's not a good situation. Don't you agree, Amy? Don't you just get completely frustrated with what happens around us? I mean,
thanks for the call, Mary Kay. Appreciate it. Mark in Plainfield.
Good morning, Dan and Amy. This once again shows the brilliance of Trump. Because you pick any number between 0 and 40, and people are going to be upset with your answer. So let's go to the states and let's see what's worked best. And if I could make two quick comments about abortion. One, how many parenthoods have Planned Parenthood actually planned? And two, if you want to drive a liberal crazy, tell them abortion should only be illegal for white women.
Should only be illegal?
Illegal for white women. And then watch them trip over themselves for obvious reasons.
Oh, yes, right. They're racist. Yes, thanks for the call. Right, well, that's why abortion mills are located in, so many abortion mills are located in minority neighborhoods. We know this. Yeah, no, I mean, there's definitely that element of those people shouldn't be having more kids, stuff that they'll actually say in unguarded moments, the same people who, like, populate the board of Personal PAC and Planned Parenthood. There's no question about it. Yeah, no, I think Trump is right on this. The IVF thing is a little bit more complicated, actually. Yeah, but I think Trump is right on this being a state issue. This is what the pro-life movement said it wanted. I mean, obviously, what we ultimately want is an end to the killing of children. That's the ultimate aim, of course. But in terms of political reality on this imperfect mortal coil, the you want terrible law, which Roe v. Wade was, overturned. The other thing, and then the states fight it out, because we still have a lot of hearts and minds work to do, don't we? And the other thing about this that I think is useful in the moment is so now Trump is devolving power away from the federal government and allowing people to chart their course in their communities and states of residence, where the left, Joe Biden, is promising to reinstate Roe v. Wade, a national right to abortion. So he's going central planning and central power, and Trump is devolving power away from the federal government, even at the same time as Trump is supposedly the power-mad autocrat, and Biden is the one saving democracy. So one person believes in federalism, and his name is not Biden. Isn't that interesting?
312-642-5600, turnkey.pro answer line. You could also text us at 64636. Type in DA, then a quick comment.
Renee in Barrington.
Yes, hi. Hi, Dan and Amy. You know, since 1973, I've been trying to change the hearts and minds of people on this issue. And I agree with Trump's position. I've come to the conclusion that if liberal women want to kill their own babies, we should let them.
Okay. Thanks for the call, Renee. I mean, the point here, and we had this discussion way back. I wrote this piece at the end of last year over at American Greatness for on this issue of jujitsuing the pro-aborts rhetoric from a bygone era, the Clinton era, using that against them. Safe, legal, and rare. In states where you know it's going to be legal, like Illinois or Wisconsin, shouldn't it be safe and rare? Isn't that what the reasonable person wants? An abortion is not something to celebrate. It's not a happy occurrence, is it?
No, so, some people do, though.
So,
weird.
Well, I know, but those help. Are, you know, those are like the ideological folks you can't get to. But for the reasonable person that doesn't want to spend a lot of time thinking about it, doesn't want it to really contemplate the consequences of this culture of death that we promote in America, the position is safe and rare. It should be legal, but where it is, safe and rare. And it so the safe part is what I was just talking about with Mary Kay, meaning surgical centers that are regulated like any other surgical center. And rare means, well, you don't want abortion as birth control, do you? You don't want this to be something that is a license to behave in a reckless manner repeatedly. So, and I think most people are going to come down and say, yeah, yeah. Just like a majority of people believe in support parental consent. In fact, a majority support parental notification. The problem the Republican Party has is if you don't concede legal, then you never get to safe and rare. And this is still going to be an issue, even with this position that Trump has taken, because the argument from the pro-abortion left is going to be, yeah, well, they're going to try what the left always does. They're going to try and get through the back door what they can't get through the front door. Regulate, 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 eliminate. Just like we talk about with respect to the gun banners of the left. And this is what they do. This is what they want to do. They've been stymied, but it's by Supreme Court decisions in particular. But regulate, 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 eliminate. So there's still a messaging challenge the Republican Party has. Just adopting the Trump position isn't enough, in my view, but it's a decent start on the abortion piece of it. Dawn in Naperville.
Hi, good morning, everybody. I guess what I would say is people are complicated, so it's a complicated issue.
Some people are.
But, yeah.
Not
but
Dan.
Other people are not complicated. Other people are about as complicated as an amoeba. But anyway, go ahead.
All right. Well, the foundational issue that everyone is missing is it's really about predators versus protectors. It's about how women are treated. And, the you know, women get angry because men sometimes don't come from a place of authority and when they speak. And so they get angry because they say, you know, you're a real hypocrite.
Yeah.
But this is the thing. The foundational issue is if women were treated with respect, if you treated a woman the way you would want your daughter treated, your viewpoint would be very different, wouldn't it? Or maybe what you speak, your pro-abortion speech would be very different in what you say in public versus what you say to your own daughter. They have to correlate with one another if you really love your neighbor.
Thanks.
So let's stop with the BS.
Thanks for the call, Dawn.
It's like a hot, steaming cup of information to start your day. It's Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560, The Answer. Only the biggest stories, only the biggest guests, and only the biggest opinions. This is AM 560, The Answer.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy. Congressman Jonathan Jackson. Turns out Jonathan Jackson is following in the family business. That would be race hustling and poverty pimping. Both. They have a couple of divisions though, over there at Jackson Incorporated. Jonathan Jackson. Some video that I was provided of Jonathan Jackson talking at a retirement party. This is the Black Fire Brigade. So you firefighters may want to perk up, make sure I've got this right. And also, when you do, help me explain why the firefighters union supports so many Democrat socialists, won't you? And then, you know, you guys pretend you have nothing to do with that. Black Fire Brigade, they got a building over at 89th and Kedzie. Does that sound right?
Yeah.
They have events there, teach black kids CPR and stuff. Jonathan Jackson talking about Chicago firefighters. Is this on? Chicago firefighters. And how the Chicago firefighters treat black neighborhoods differently than they do white neighborhoods when it comes to fighting fire.
I want to ask Ed McCain about firefighting and why so many buildings in our neighborhood are boarded up. So follow me carefully. He says because some people working in these battalions and in these firehouses used to live in these neighborhoods, and they are so angry they had to leave and they left when we came. That when there's a fire and they go there, they watch the building burn. He said, go to the north side. If you see 16 units, 25 units in a building, they go and put out the fire in the single unit. We have a fire in one unit, and the whole building gets evacuated. Because we didn't have people that lived in the community that cared about the community, that wanted to put the fire out. They had so much contempt, they let the building burn. So to stop that level of homelessness and to stop the self-destruction, we need more black first responders, more black firefighters. Thank you for all that you do in the Black Fire Brigade. Congratulations.
You got that? So you honky firefighters in Chicago, you were forced to move, or you chose to, sort of the white flight argument. You chose to move from neighborhoods you used to live in. Then you got up because black residents had moved in. And then when you were called to fight a fire in those neighborhoods that you used to live in, that black, that are now majority black, you don't fight fires. You just watch the buildings burn because you're so upset that black people displaced you from your home. And so in the white neighborhoods, when you got the honky firefighters that respond, like on the north side, in a multifamily unit, there's a fire in one unit, they go in and they just fight the fire in the one unit and so on and so forth. You don't evacuate the whole building and let it burn. In the black neighborhoods, there's a fire in one unit, kitchen fire, let's say, in one unit. They evacuate the whole building, and then all you honky firefighters just stand around and watch it burn because you hate black people. Congressman Jonathan Jackson.
312-642-5600, turnkey.pro, answer line 64636, type in DA, then a quick comment. Does he have any proof to back up that just random statement that he made?
He talked to somebody.
Oh, one person? Oh, really? Talked to somebody?
So he said,
I know firefighters who live on the north side who chose to go to west side firehouses because they want to stay busy. They want, and they would never in a million years do what he said they did, that sit there and watch a place burn because they were displaced as firefighters, forced out of their neighborhood. That's just race hustling at its finest, right? That is a very Jackson move.
Yeah, that's the
very Jackson-esque.
Jackson family doing what it do. Doing what it do. Jackson Incorporated.
Did you tweet that out?
No, I just wanted to hold it for our little show here and get people's reaction. No firefighters? No firefighters want to chime in? Don't want to address the
former firefighter, retired firefighter,
the race hustling, public safety people in general, because of course honky first responders are racist, and that's why black neighborhoods receive inferior first responder services, police, fire, paramedics, because of systemic racism, because of the legacies of slavery, because of white supremacist, white ethnics that populate the ranks of these departments, right? And that's why we needed a triple threat, a BLM Brandon, a Jonathan Jackson to remedy these corrupted institutions corrupted by systemic racism. Yeah.
And he wants Dick Durbin's seat. When
defund the police. Yeah. I mean, don't stop there.
Defund firefighters?
You got to defund the whole white supremacist power structure. The whole Trump-supporting MAGA cultist power structure, police, fire, and first responders generally. I mean, how much have we heard about John Cantanzara, the FOP boss, being a MAGA cultist? But I suspect what you'll see happen is nobody will kick up any dust.
They should. Firefighters union, hello.
They should.
Firefighters.
They'll murmur to themselves and they'll say that Jonathan Jackson is a race hustler. But, you know, I'm not going to make a big thing about it. I'm not going to provide any public pushback. Certainly the union won't, because, I mean, you know, you don't want to draw the ire of the actual political power structure. You don't want to put yourself on the line. I got a couple more years and I got a retirement, or I got a good gig and I'm climbing the ladder, pun intended. And I don't want to disrupt that. So, you know, I don't want to play politics. I don't want to play politics until they tell me I have to play politics on behalf of the people that are the race hustlers. Then I'll play politics, because I'm just following orders. Mm-hmm. Right? Steve, Northwest Side, you're on Chicago's Morning Answer.
Hey, I wanted to say one thing. Actually, I wanted to say two things. But the first thing I want to say is this. Apparently, the apple doesn't fall far from the tree, does it? And if I can add one more comment about another matter you guys talked about a week or so ago, when that guy, I can't think of his name, when he called in, Tom from Deer Park, I think, and John Cass put him in his place. Would you personally thank John Cass for me? Because that guy has been calling you for a long time with his anti-Trump nonsense. He drives me up a wall, and finally someone told him off and put him in his place where he belongs. He's a lunatic, and I just wish John would have told him, hey, Trump was invited to the funeral. So thanks.
Thanks for the call, Steve. Yeah, we've got our trolls like Tom from Deer Park. It's okay. I think I've put him in his place once or twice too. Will and Skokie are on Chicago's Morning Answer.
Hey, how you doing, guys? I'm a home inspector, and we learned early on that if you see a house or a building that has a big red X over the door, that's condemned building. You're not supposed to go in there because it's structurally unsound. And even firemen aren't supposed to go in if there's a fire. And I've been on site a couple of times where there was fires in those kind of buildings, and the firemen are there, and they're just trying to keep the fire from spreading to surrounding houses and stuff like this. But the neighborhood is out there going, oh, no, why aren't you fighting the fire? This is racist. This is racist. And I've seen this in both black neighborhoods and Hispanic neighborhoods. And it's basically the leftist thing, they prey on ignorance. And ignorance isn't a bad thing. It just means you don't know. And most people don't know about that condemned building signal. And that's how the left plays it. They tell you a half story, or they prey on your ignorance to rile you up and get you to go for them. So anyway, hope that thanks.
Thanks for the call, Will.
A text message from a 40-year career firefighter. Amy, I'm disgusted by Jackson's remarks. I chose, and so did my brothers and sisters, to go to the bad neighborhoods and fight fires, and they were the best firemen ever, and shame on the black firefighter who was standing next to him.
Well, I
in
think
that video.
There's more than one. I mean, there's one standing next to him, but there's many in the audience. I tell you what, I think some more die courses are in order.
Oh.
Let me be the first to, propose the obvious partial remedy to this, and that is the honkies have to come in for more die training. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I don't want to hear these trumped up, and I mean trumped up, excuses about condemned buildings or unsafe conditions. We know. Honkies. Damn honkies. First responders. Tim in Mount Greenwood.
Yes, I'm retired 10 years from the fire department.
Okay.
All right, what do you think?
Are there any sins you'd like to confess?
No, I spent my career in Englewood, 34 years, and there was none of that stuff going on. This is just race hustling. I think the whole agenda is they got rid of Appendix G in the contract, and the federal government took it out, and that created a system where they were entitled to X amount of promotions on every list. And they took it away because they met the standard of Chicago Fire Department. Now they're trying to figure out another way around where they can get the promotions. Their problem is they promoted so many people in the upper echelon that are minorities. That counts against the lower ranks.
Oh, so you're talking about this Appendix G you speak of is with respect to so many minority promotions. Is that it?
Promotion of minority firefighters. They did it in 1980 when they settled the strike, and I think that Jonathan Jackson's father was involved in it.
Oh, I'm sure.
Now it's gone. So now this is another way around so they can push their agenda. And, of course, when you, like you said, when you go after these people and ask them what they meant, well, that was told us. That's a complete fabrication. It's garbage. That's why I vote Republican. I could care less about these Democrats.
There you go. Thanks for the call, Tim. Jim, Lincoln Square.
Hey, Dan, Amy, how are you? So, Dan, I was a firefighter for 40 years in Chicago, and in my 40-year career, the best firemen always sought to go to the busiest neighborhoods, right. Englewood, the West Side, to fight fires. And guess what? We went in to fight the fire, and we saved many lives. And I was so livid when I saw that video yesterday. Someone said it to me. I was never so upset because it's such BS, this Jackson guy. He's full of it. And it was the fireman standing next to him that should have spoke up and told the truth. Tell that to Herbie Johnson, who was a captain on the South Side. He used to work at 78's house across from Wrigley there. Amy probably knew him. It's just so upsetting to me. We fight. They're the best firemen in the city that go to those neighborhoods. The best firemen in the city. They seek it out. So it's very upsetting. So he's full of BS.
Thanks for the call, Jim. Appreciate it. Well, yeah, but that's how it goes. You know, that's the identitarian politics of the day. Whatever. The truth is, sorry, Jim. Sorry for, you know, besmirching your 40 years of fighting fires and your colleagues as well. But, you know, we're going to have to throw you under the fire truck, as it were, because, you know, we've got this identitarian leverage play to make in order to get more stuff to distribute that gets us more political support so that I can climb on the backs of firefighters to the next political rung on my ladder, right? Hey, it's just politics. Don't take it personal. It's just don't take, you know, me calling you a racist, a white supremacist, unprofessional. Don't take accusing you of costing people their lives because you're a racist. Don't take it personal. It's just Chicago politics.
It's like a hot, steaming cup of information to start your day. It's Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560, The Answer.
Thanks for listening to Chicago's Morning Answer podcast, sponsored by Signature Bank. Signature Bank takes pride in helping customers grow their business and provide unmatched banking expertise, custom financial solutions, and the industry's best technology. So whether you're a business looking for a deposit relationship or needs a ready source of financing, Signature Bank is the right bank for you. Call today at 773-467-5600 to hear how Signature Bank can help your business grow and thrive. Member FDIC, Equal Housing Lender.